So, Steve, who would win in a fight between Clement Attlee and Harold Macmillan?
Did Macmillan serve in the army?
I think so.
Okay, yeah. I was going to say, if he didn't, then I know Attlee did. So I would assume that, you know, Attlee would win just because he'd have a few more bayonet skills handy. But
show him the old cold steel.
Yeah, pretty much.
They don't like it up in Munich.
No, they never do. They never do. I don't know. Let's say Attlee.
If it was a pistol fight, if it was like a duel, I imagine Macmillan would probably win. I imagine he's
yeah, but if we're talking duels, then that depends on the weaponry. Because if it's like swords, then Attlee hands down over Macmillan.
Probably.
So what? Why are we discussing prime ministers dueling each other?
We're talking. Well, this episode of Not Enough Champagne is about what makes a good prime minister. Now, maybe physical strength might not be a quality you want. I mean, maybe you've changed in a few weeks since we started recording. You might, you know, be in favour of Nietzschean supermensch or something.
Not quite. Not although yet. The fact that we're cracking jokes about Nietzsche and Ubermensch does kind of show us a lot about what this podcast is about.
We're all about the mass market appeal, guys. So what we're going to do, we're going to talk about what would make a good prime minister, and also then feed that in, because since we last met up, we have a new prime minister. So we can talk about, will Theresa May be a good prime minister? Was David Cameron a good prime minister? We'll discuss all of that and probably a little bit less.
Or summarised as, is Theresa May the Ubermensch?
Anthony King talks about there being two kinds of prime minister. He says that most prime ministers want to keep the show on the road. They want to be prime minister more than they actually wanted to do anything.
Careerist bastards.
Yeah, I think Gordon Brown is maybe a very good example, where he wanted to be prime minister for so long, but then didn't really seem to know what to do with it when he got there. Maybe he was just really tired.
Yeah, I mean, that. I'll be honest, that sounds like there's a certain degree of truth to it. I think you can certainly look at a number of individuals that applies to. You've mentioned Gordon Brown, but I also think that probably applies to David Cameron.
I think it applies to Cameron.
I think if things hadn't gone horrifically wrong for him, that would probably have applied to Osborne. I think it probably applies to Boris, if he should ever, God help us, actually get there.
It's too early in the day for that kind of horrific recording. They have to mention this explicit on iTunes now.
I mean, there are a certain type of people who get into politics because they want to do things, and there are a certain type of people who get into politics because they want to be something.
Yeah, I think Cameron seems, and Anthony King says it as well, he seems more interested in the prestige and the perks of the job, seems more interested in foreign travel than actually changing something. He doesn't seem to be terribly ideological, except maybe strangely in campaigning for gay marriage. That seems to be one of the things where he was very
active.
Really active, and maybe one of the things that if people trying to paint his prime ministership as a success will probably look at that. I honestly don't think David Cameron was a particularly good prime minister. I think people will see him as a bit more of a John Major figure. He'll be seen as someone who, as Peter Hennessy says, Major succumbed to the political weather. He didn't make the political weather, but he was ground down. I mean, and parallels over Europe as well.
Yeah.
I think
Cameron, in terms of his historical kind of record and how he'll be viewed in the history books, is probably going to be viewed not as a brilliant prime minister, but I don't think he'll be viewed as a bad one. When you look at the fact that he was the first Tory prime minister in God knows how many years.
That's true.
And then managed to take the Tory party from still a minority in the House of Commons, having to work in a coalition with the Liberal Democrats, up to a majority. That's an impressive feat in and of itself. Yes, there are a number of things where he didn't necessarily, I don't want to say think things through, but, you know, he made the wrong call on a number of different things, such as the EU referendum. But overall, I think he's an all right prime minister. But I don't think he's been a bad one. I mean, as you say, the aspects that are probably defining of his premiership are Brexit and equal and gay marriage.
I think he'll be remembered more for Brexit, in the same way, like Eden, you think of Suez, it's a bit catastrophic.
Mm-hmm.
Blair, Iraq is what he'll be remembered for. I think Cameron will be remembered for Brexit. He'll be the Prime Minister who promised to stop banging on about Europe and then departed in an almighty shitstorm.
When you look at things from the kind of the historical viewpoint, there's a difference between the popular conception and what was actually there and what the almost, I suppose, the academic conception was.
Mm.
So let's take an almost classic example of this, of Neville Chamberlain. The popular conception of him is of a bad prime minister who failed, wandered off of that plane, waving that folio of papers, declaring peace in our time.
Mm.
From an actual perspective of a historian studying the period, you go, one, there was no alternative at that point. We couldn't have gone to war because we'd have been had our asses kicked. That delay actually brought us enough time to, you know, fix the Spitfire, which was obviously fundamental to ensuring that Britain didn't fall to the Germans.
That's true.
So you have these kind of differences in opinion between what the popular culture, I suppose, views something as and what the historical view is. And over time, those tend to kind of coalesce.
I do wonder if that will happen to Gordon Brown as well, because I think historians might see Gordon Brown as the man who, A, kept Britain out of the Euro. I think that would be seen as something very significant. And who, B, he bailed out the banks at the right time, something which were Cameron and Osborne opposed in opposition, but probably needed to be done. So I wonder if those two things will mean maybe he's seen more charitably than he is at the moment, when I think his prime ministership mainly was a failure. He kind of was exhausted, but I wonder if those two things will stand him in good stead.
Yeah, and I think that will probably work in his favour. I think what also helps, actually, is the people that come directly after you. So in the case of Chamberlain, was succeeded by Churchill, who was very good at presenting himself as this, or building a mythos around himself as this literally Churchillian figure. We even have a word to describe it, somebody who's being like Churchill. That's how effective
selling car
he was.
Insurance.
Yeah, that's that's exactly how effective he was at kind of building this mythos, and how much we as a culture have bought into it. But the reality was, Churchill was a piss poor prime minister after the war, and the reason that Churchill stood down with the whole Norwegian fiasco was because of Churchill in the first place. It was his screw up, but it's all about the remembrances of the popular culture.
Well, I suppose, so we've talked about these two different kinds of prime minister. If we can then widen it out a little bit, Peter Hennessy, in his book on the prime ministers, he talks about seasoned copers but not transformers.
Yeah.
So in terms of prime ministers who want to keep the show on the road, maybe you've got the kind of a Cameron type who essentially seem to be careerists, just want to be there and have a job. But Callaghan and Churchill maybe are seen as trying to cope in quite a good way. So, for instance, Churchill trying to cope with Britain post-empire in that kind of Cold War world. But Callaghan as well, although I think now Callaghan is seen as a bit of a failure, winter of discontent, IMF, rubbish not being collected, all that kind of stuff. Actually, I think historians look on him quite well, because maybe nobody else could have kept his party together during those IMF talks in 1976. You might have seen much more resignations if Callaghan hadn't balanced his party really well.
Yeah, and I think, again, you've touched on something there which I think is probably going to be relevant to Cameron and his legacy and the way he's viewed, is that it all depends on what happens afterwards with the Tory party. If Theresa May, by whatever measure, ends up being a complete failure, I don't think that's likely, but it is plausible. Let's say that the Brexit deal that she cuts isn't good enough for John Redwood and his wing of the party. They split off, join UKIP, form their own new party or something like that. As a result of it all, of the Brexit deal we get, it's still not enough to keep the Scots happy, and then they have another independence referendum and vote to leave. You know, suddenly David Cameron looks a hell of a lot better in contrast to the person who failed to keep the union together, failed to keep the Tory party together, two things he actually succeeded in
doing. I think the coalition will look a lot better. I think that Nick Clegg, I think, will look much more, certainly historians, I think, will look at him much more positively in hindsight, which is vaguely hilarious, I think. I think you're right. I think Theresa May has a really difficult hand, and you can see how it could go badly very quickly, because the thing with the Tory leadership election, where they kind of got it all done and all dusted, and Andrea Leadsom very gamely fell on her sword, you could almost feel the Tory party kind of smelling power and wanting to come together while Labour in an absolute shambles. It depends that, as you say, it completely depends how those Brexit negotiations go. I think Theresa May, she doesn't just want to be someone who copes with Brexit, who copes with this difficult hand that she's got. She wants to be, as Peter Hennessy called it a scene shifter. So you've got, for instance, Heath and Blair. Mm-hmm. They maybe wanted to be more transformational than they were. I mean, Heath wanted to break the post-war consensus. It didn't happen. They still changed quite a bit. I mean, Heath took us into Europe. That worked out well. It's obvious from Theresa May's rhetoric, from her speech, that she does see the Brexit vote as this vote against the status quo. She's talked really radically. I mean, her speech outside Number 10, Ed Miliband could have given in some weird alternative political universe.
Well, I mean, this is the thing. Ed Miliband basically tweeted maybe a day or so after the speech was given, I think, and kind of he just quipped that he was available to give advice on further policy announcements or something like that, because, as you say, so much of that speech could have been given by Ed Miliband. Putting workers on the boards of directors, that's straight out of the Miliband playbook, for instance. I mean, I think the thing to note with kind of opening statements such as that of a new premier is that there's never been a prime minister who stood outside Number 10 and said, I want to make this, I want to make people more unequal. I want to make sure there's worse education opportunities for our children. I want to ensure that the NHS doesn't have the funding it requires. Because, you know, one, no one wants to see that. And two, if you did actually believe that, you wouldn't get anywhere near power. Words such as that are, in many ways, a bit meaningless. Because everybody says that sort of stuff. The policy prescriptions are much more indicative and interesting. But it depends on how they happen and if they will happen at all. Because with the workers on the boards idea, also I don't think it's a terrible idea. I think it's a reasonable one. I don't think it's going to radically change anything particularly. But you've already got some kickback from the Tory party, especially more the kind of free market wing of it.
It will be interesting to see. I think also it's her evocation of Joseph Chamberlain is interesting as well. I mean, this all comes from her one campaign speech, which was in Birmingham, so evoking Joseph Chamberlain in Birmingham is just politeness, maybe. But it does seem like the advisers around her do like Joseph Chamberlain's vision of municipalism, maybe a bit of localism.
Well, her policy director, I can't remember the guy's name, he's from Erdington, which is in Birmingham. The Conservative Home website, I think that they've coined a term for his kind of vision of politics, and they called it something like Aston Villa conservatism or something like that. Working class Toryism, but with aspiration.
It ends in relegation from the top flight and financial collapse. I can see that. I can definitely see that happening. Let's talk about the roles of the PM then, because I think one thing which a Prime Minister has to do is set the political direction of the government. And Theresa May has definitely done that. We've talked a little bit about that. Very much putting tanks on Labour's law. It's not just the kind of speech that Ed Miliband, it's the kind of speech I imagine George Osborne would have given as well. Mm. One also is managing cabinet appointments.
Yeah.
What's interesting, I think, about Theresa May is her political direction is very centrist. In terms of the rhetoric, it's very centrist. But in terms of her cabinet, it really isn't. I mean, I don't want to talk a lot about Boris's foreign secretary because a lot of stuff has been said. We're going to talk about it on a later podcast anyway. But if I was going to be a centrist Tory prime minister, I would not sack Michael Gove and a lot of the Cameron set and then bring in David Davis and Liam Fox. It's a very right-tilting cabinet, don't you think?
It is, but when you actually look at the ones that necessarily, you know, in the areas which probably matter a bit more in terms of like the left-right divide. Amber Rudd is the Home Secretary. She's a Cameroon in a lot of ways. Well, she's brought back Damien Green, who again, he's not necessarily a kind of a Ken Clark type, but he's not.
He's a bit damp.
He's a bit damp. He's yeah. he's part of the wet. He's part of the wet wing of the Tories. The real right wingers that have been brought in have been put on for Brexit. Well, it had to be a right winger, had to be one of the Brexiteers. So bringing David Davis, okay, that makes sense. Trade in the form of with Liam Fox. What does left wing or right wing matter to that sort of thing? Okay, maybe it matters in terms of the extent of the free market nature of it. So whilst she has definitely brought in more right wingers, she's put them in positions where doesn't necessarily matter that they're right wing. Mm. And indeed, she's put them in the positions where if they fail, then it damages the right wing cause quite substantially.
I think what's interesting with the appointment of the more right wing Tories is the Brexiters in charge of foreign policy. They are going to clean up their own mess. But I think it's going to be very difficult to manage this party as you say, there's a very slender majority. I mean, the working majority of this government is 16. I think 23 ministers have been sacked from the government for one reason or another. And it is interesting that it's a lot of them are the Cameron set, but often it also seems to be ministers on either side of the referendum result who attacked other Conservatives. So people like Anna Sowerby, for instance, who have left the government, or Michael Gove, who attacked other fellow Conservatives. That seems to be the dividing line, which I think is interesting.
That's interesting. I hadn't actually thought of it like that. But yeah, there is a certain element of almost party loyalty to it. It's, are you prepared to put the party first above your own opinions? As you said, the people who have left the government are split. Are split between Remainers and Brexiteers, and they are largely speaking, and they're going to break down on left wing and right wing Tory lines as well. So, with that in mind, what are they actually going to vote against, really? That would cost her that working majority on a policy issue, because if it's, I don't know, something like civil liberties, where she is very authoritarian. And we've got lots of evidence behind that. Yeah, Michael Gove may very well vote against, just out of principle. Anna Sowerby might, out of principle. But Teresa Villiers? Probably not. I don't think there are actually that many Conservatives who are actually sat there kind of plotting kind of revenge for this sort of stuff. I think it's not in the sense of trying to, you know, vote down policy. At least, because at the end of the day, they probably agree with most of the policies that are going to be put forward.
Mm. I suppose it's about trying to manage the serial rebels already. I mean, there were a group of serial rebels who were quite right-wing during the coalition, and they tend to be rebelling on matters about Europe. And we've got a lot of stuff about Brexit and about trade. But I can imagine that if there's some sort of single market access deal, and we have to have free movement of labour as part of that, I don't think the Tory party a lot of the Tory MPs are going to wear that.
Yeah, that is true, but the people you're talking about rebelling there aren't the people that have been fired from government. Michael Gove will vote for your social justice things, and Michael Gove will vote for prison reform. Michael Gove will vote for all of the things that the Tory wets traditionally like, because he is basically a Tory wet. He's actually a pretty liberal bloke on a lot of issues.
It was a shame to see him go from justice. I mean, I think he was a terrible education secretary.
Yeah, education, he was not good.
In many ways, the government would have been better if David Cameron just appointed his cat education secretary for 6 years. It would have caused less damage to education than having Gove there. But he was making some nice noises on prison reform. What I'd like to talk about, just finally, is communication. So the political scientists, and I think, as we've indicated from our podcast in the Overton Window, probably the two best, regardless of your politics, the two most effective prime ministers we've had since the war have been Clement Attlee and Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah.
They are the people who shifted that Overton Window. They completely changed the political direction of the country.
Yeah.
One of the things, especially now in this kind of mass media world, this 24-hour news media, one of the most important things to do is be the PR spokesman for your government, communication. Do you think someone like Clement Attlee, who, I mean, let's be honest, Clement Attlee makes John Major look like some sort of Adonis dripping with charisma. Could someone like Clement Attlee become Prime Minister nowadays?
No, I don't think they could, to be quite honest. And I think a lot of people sit down and kind of go, oh, isn't that a shame? To which my response is, not necessarily. The vast bulk of what makes a Prime Minister great isn't their own ability. It's the people around them. It's their cabinet. It's the people that are able to do stuff with them. I think Attlee's a very useful figurehead in a lot of ways, for the Labour Party, especially to kind of rally around and focus on. But I don't think he as an individual was actually that great. He was effective at helping bring in this change, but the change was the bedrock of the work was done by Beveridge with his report. The actual implementation of it was of the NHS say was done by Anura and Bevan. So it wasn't Attlee himself that did all of it. But
Attlee did it in 6 years, with very little resources in a country that had just come out of the Second World War and was very tired and morale was very low. So I think although Thatcher did more to break a consensus and usher in a new consensus and stamp her stamp her mark on it really, really effectively. I think actually Attlee was a really effective figure at getting stuff done, at managing people like Nye Bevin, who, again, I wonder if someone as outspoken, temperamental as Nye Bevin could become a cabinet minister nowadays, but that's maybe a slight different discussion.
Yeah.
I wonder if someone as almost deliberately uncharismatic, someone as, for instance, there's a nice anecdote I found while researching this, which is that the way that Francis Williams, Attlee's communications guy, could get a news agency tape into Number 10, he sold it to Attlee as a way that he could get the cricket scores and have a break.
That's amazing.
That is someone who just would not want to handle 24-hour news media.
No, and as I say, I don't think Attlee would do very, very, very well in the kind of the modern context of politics. But as I say, I think when people kind of bemoan the fact that Attlee or Bevin or whoever might not have been able to make it as a kind of a frontline politician in these days, I think they're missing one vital fact, that the context has changed. We're not just looking for managers anymore, actually, which is in effect what a lot of those people were. We're either looking for inspiration, i.e. the Corbynistas and Corbyn, to a certain extent the Tories and May, or we're looking for just competence and steady as you go. Those two things are very much require in the modern concept, what we expect as people. If there's a disaster or a crisis, we don't want a press release, we want to see the Prime Minister, because we do have a television now. And we want to be able to see that speech ourselves. The context has changed, and as a result of that context, our expectation as people has changed, or as a citizenry has changed. And as a result of that, the skill sets that politicians needed has shifted, which means, Clement Attlee, Nye Bevin, probably a whole host of political figures would have never been able to be as successful as they are.
Is that necessarily a good thing, though? I mean, yes, 1945 is a long time ago. I mean, it's 70-odd years ago.
Yeah.
It does almost feel a bit like bemoaning, well, Henry IV couldn't possibly become Prime Minister anymore. You know, we don't need to fight war with France or look good on horses. Like, in terms of that competence and managerialism, just because you're a good PR person and look good on television, that doesn't necessarily mean you'll be a good manager.
No, absolutely. That's not what I'm saying. Yeah, you're right. You can be incredibly charismatic and be a terrible team leader. You can be a terrible kind of manager. Case in point, Boris Johnson. All the reports that come out of a lot of from his time as mayor are that he wasn't very good at actually managing and dealing with people. And that's something which you can pick up on across a whole host of his career, across various newspapers, for instance. But you're not just managing the cabinet as Prime Minister, you're managing the nation as a whole, and that includes us as the citizens. And a big part of making us feel secure and us feel like we are in a safe pair of hands when something is going down is the ability to just stand up and be a reassuring figure. And that means not bumbling. That means being able to present yourself as a calm, stoic figure.
But again, I think Attlee could do that.
I don't think he could.
I think he's a very... Sorry, chaps, there's been a bit of a problem here. It appears we're a bit more with Russia. You know, I can see. Can't you just accept that the fact that Clement Attlee couldn't become Prime Minister now is a damning indictment on our political system?
No.
Okay, moving on. I think there's one more thing I'd like to discuss just quickly, which is, for various reasons, it's that we have a more presidential system of Prime Minister than we had 30 or 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
In 1970, Harold Wilson was rated higher than Ted Heath in the polls. He was seen as more popular.
Yeah.
But Heath won the election. In 1979, Callaghan was more popular than Thatcher, personally.
Yeah.
That didn't help him in the election. Could someone with worse favourability ratings as Prime Minister, could they go on to win the election? I mean, one of the reasons why Ed Miliband seemed to lose last year is because his favourability wasn't as good as Cameron.
No, I don't think that could. But again, I think it's due to the shifting context and the period that we're in. I think with Callaghan and the others you mentioned, that it was all down to not just the perception of them as the individual, but also the party as a whole. Whilst I think the shift towards a more presidential style of politics that we have in this country at the moment is, let's be honest, in 2015 we weren't voting. Whilst you were voting for your local MP, a lot of people voted because either to have Ed Miliband as Prime Minister or David Cameron as Prime Minister, and that is a massive factor in how a lot of people vote and think. And as a result of that, as a result of the 24-hour news media, where either the Prime Minister's putting out a statement and giving out things, or and therefore the opposition is responding to it, people start to look more strongly at the leaders of the parties rather than the party as a whole. And as such, I think our definition of what favourable, like, you know, looking favourably upon someone is, has changed. So I think perhaps before it might have been a case of, do I like this person? But yes or no. But do I rate the Tory party or the Labour party? Well, I dislike Callaghan, but I like Labour, for instance.
Yeah.
You can still see how that might work. With modern stuff, I don't think you have that separation anymore. I think the leaders become their own brands. And you can see a lot of evidence of that in, for instance, with Liberal Democrats. For a lot of the time during the coalition period, it was Nick Clegg's Liberal Democrats. It was very much on the website and things like that. And I think it was very much with the Tories, David Cameron's Conservative Party. Because he was more popular than the party.
I think you can probably... It would be interesting to track a leader's decline and fall depending on how much local parties put the leader's photo on election leaflets. So I think certainly in Clegg Mania in 2010,
Nick Clegg was everywhere.
And then towards the end of the coalition years, they couldn't run away from him fast enough and Nick Clegg was nowhere. And so that's it for this week. Be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes. We've just started that this week. So if you do like us, please subscribe on there and spread the word. So, see you next week. Bye.
Bye.
I think we should write a show called The Wet Wing. About the Liberal ring of the Tory party. We could anyway.